carried provided the Spartan with an advantage that none of the Marines possessed, so he focused most of his attention on the elites, leaving the jackals and grunts for others to handle. Cortana, meanwhile, was hard at work tapping into the ship's electronic nervous system in an attempt to find the best way out of the trap.
"We need a way out of this bay now," the Master Chief told her, "or there won't be anyone left to complete the mission."
He ducked behind a crate, emptied his magazine into a charging grunt who wielded a plasma grenade, then paused to reload. A hunter gave a blood-curdling roar as it charged into the fray. The Spartan turned and saw Sergeant Parker fire at the massive alien. A trio of bullets spat from his assault rifle, the last three rounds in the weapon. He discarded the empty gun and backpedaled in an attempt to buy himself some time. His hand dipped for his sidearm. The hunter sprang forward, and the tips of the beast's razor spine shredded through the Marine's ballistic armor. He crashed to the deck. The Master Chief cursed under his breath, slapped a fresh clip into place, and racked around into the chamber and took aim on the hunter. The alien was coming on fast, too fast, and the Spartan knew he wasn't going to get a kill shot in time. The hunter stepped past Sergeant Parker's prone form. The alien's razor spine sprang into view, and it roared again as the Spartan sprayed it with gunfire, knowing the gesture was futile, but unwilling to let the enemy at his teammate's exposed flank. Without warning, the hunter reared up, howled, and crashed to the ground. The Master Chief was puzzled, and briefly checked his weapon. Could he have gotten in a lucky shot? He heard a cough, and saw Sergeant Parker struggling to his feet, a smoking M60 pistol in his hand. Blood flowed from the gashes in his side, and he was unsteady on his feet, but he found the strength to spit on the hunter's fallen corpse. The chief took a covering position near the wounded sergeant. He gave him a brisk nod.
"Not bad for a Marine. Thanks."
The sergeant grabbed the fallen assault rifle, slammed a fresh magazine into place, and grinned.
"Any time, swabby."
His motion sensor showed more contacts inbound, but they were keeping their distance. Their failed assault on the bay must have left them disorganized. "Good," he thought. "We need all the time we can get."
"Cortana," he said, "how much longer before you get a door open?"
"Got it,"
Cortana proclaimed exultantly. One of the heavy doors hissed open.
"Everyone should move through the door now. I can't guarantee that it won't lock when it closes."
"Follow me,"
he barked, then led the surviving Marines out of the shuttle bay and into the comparative safety of a corridor beyond. The next 15 minutes were like a slow-motion nightmare as the rescuers fought their way through a maze of corridors, up a series of narrow ramps, and onto the launch bay's upper level. With Cortana's guidance, they plunged back into the ship's oppressive passageways. As they proceeded through the bowels of the large warship, Cortana finally gave them good news.
"The captain's signal is strong. He must be close."
The chief frowned. This was taking too long. Every passing second made it that much less likely that any of the rescue party would be able to get off the Truth and Reconciliation alive, let alone with Captain Keyes. The ODSTs were good fighters, but they were slowing him down. He turned to Sergeant Parker and said,
"Hold your men here. I'll be back soon with the captain."
He started to protest, then nodded.
"Just don't tell Silva," he said. "I won't."
The Master Chief ran from door to door until one of them opened to reveal a rectangular room lined with cells. It appeared that the translucent force field served in place of bars. He dashed inside and called the captain's name, but received no answer. A quick check confirmed that, with the exception of one dead Marine, the detention center was empty. Frustrated, yet reassured by Cortana's insistence that the CNI signal remained strong, the Spartan exited the room, entered the hall, and literally went door to door searching for the correct hatch. Once he located it, the Master Chief almost wished he hadn't. The portal slid open. A grunt yelled something the Master Chief couldn't understand, and a plasma beam lashed past the human's helmet. The Master Chief opened fire, heard a Marine yell from within one of the cells,
"Good to see you, Chief,"
and knew he was in the right place. A plasma beam appeared out of nowhere, hit the Spartan in the chest, and triggered the armor's audible alarm. He ducked behind a support column, just in time to see an energy beam slice through the spot he had just vacated. He scanned the room, looking for his assailant. Nothing. His motion sensor showed faint trace movements, but he couldn't spot their source. His eyes narrowed, and he noticed a slight shimmer in the air directly in front of him. He fired a sustained burst through the middle of it, and was rewarded with a loud howl. The elite seemed to materialize out of thin air, made a grab for his own entrails, and managed to catch them before he died. He strode to the access controls, and with Cortana's help, killed the force fields. Captain Keyes stepped out of his cell, paused to scoop a needler off the floor, and met the chief's eyes.
"Coming here was reckless," he said, his voice harsh.
The chief was about to explain his orders when Keyes' expression warmed, and the Autumn CO smiled.
"Thanks."
The Spartan nodded.
"Any time, sir."
"Can you find your way out?" Keyes inquired doubtfully. "The corridors of this ship are like a maze."
"It shouldn't be too difficult," the Master Chief replied. "All we have to do is follow the bodies."
Lieutenant Cookie Peterson put Echo 136 down a full click from the Pillar of Autumn, looked out through the rain-spattered windscreen, and saw Echo 206 settle in approximately 50 meters away. It had been an uneventful flight, thanks in part to the weather, and the fact that the assault on the Truth and Reconciliation had probably served to distract the Covenant from what was going on elsewhere. Peterson felt the ship shudder as the ramp hit the ground, waited for the crew chief to call,
"Clear!"
and fired the Pelican's thrusters. The ship was extremely vulnerable while on the ground, and he was eager to return to the relative safety of Alpha Base. Then, assuming the Helljumpers got the job done, he and his crew would be back to transport some of the survivors and their loot. Back at Alpha Base, McKay watched Echo 136 wobble as a gust of wind hit the Pelican from the side, saw the ship gather speed, and start to climb out. Echo 206 took off a few minutes later, and both ships were gone within a matter of seconds. Her people knew what they were doing, so rather than make a pest of herself, McKay decided to wait and watch as the platoon leaders sorted things out. The officer felt the usual moments of fear, of self-doubt regarding her ability to accomplish the mission, but took comfort from something an instructor once told her. "Take a look around," the instructor had advised. "Ask yourself if there's anyone else who is better qualified to do the job. Not on the entire galaxy, but right there, at that point in time. If the answer is yes, ask them to accept command and do everything you can to support them. If the answer is no, which it will be 99% of the time, then take your best shot. That's all any of us can do." It was good advice, the kind that made a difference, and while it didn't erase McKay's fears, it certainly served to ease them. Master Sergeant Lister and Second Lieutenant Oros seemed to materialize out of the darkness. Oros had a small, pixie-like face which belied her innate toughness. If anything happened to McKay, Oros would take over, and if she bought the farm, Lister would step in. The battalion had been short of officers before the shit hit the fan, and what with Lieutenant Delu off playing supply officer, McKay was one platoon leader short of a full load. That's why Lister had been called upon to fill the hole.
"Platoons 1 and 2 are ready to go," Oros reported cheerfully. "Let us at 'em."
"You just want to raid the ship's commissary," McKay said, referring to the platoon leader's well-known addiction to chocolate.
"No, ma'am," Oros replied innocently. "The lieutenant lives only to serve the needs of humanity, the Marine Corps, and the company commander."
Even the normally stone-faced Lister had to laugh at that, and McKay felt her own spirits lift as well.
"Okay, Lieutenant Oros, the human race would be grateful if you would put a couple of your best people on point and lead this outfit to the ship. I'll ride your 6 with Sergeant Lister and the 2nd platoon walking drag. You okay with that?"
Both platoon leaders nodded and melted into the night. McKay looked for the tail end of the 1st platoon, slid into line, and let her mind roam ahead. Somewhere, about 1 kilometer ahead, the Pillar of Autumn lay sprawled on the ground. The Covenant owned the ship for the moment, but McKay was determined to take her back. It was time to get off the Truth and Reconciliation. As Covenant troops ran hither and yon, the recently freed Marines armed themselves with alien weapons, then linked up with the rest of the rescue team. Keyes and Cortana convened a quick council of war.
"While the Covenant had us locked up in here, I heard them talking about the Ringworld," Keyes said, "and its destructive capabilities."
"One moment, sir," Cortana interrupted. "I'm accessing the Covenant Battle.net."
She paused as her vastly powerful intrusion protocols sifted through the Covenant systems. Information systems seemed to be the one field where human technologies held their own against those of the Covenant. Seconds later, she finished her sift of the alien data stream.
"If I'm interpreting the data correctly, they believe Halo is some kind of weapon, one that possesses vast, unimaginable power."
Keyes nodded thoughtfully.
"The aliens who interrogated me kept saying that whoever controls Halo controls the fate of the universe."
"Now I see," Cortana put in thoughtfully. "I intercepted a number of messages about a Covenant search team scouting for a control room. I thought they were looking for the bridge of the ship I damaged during the battle above the ring, but they must be looking for Halo's control room."
"That's bad news," Keyes responded gravely. "If Halo is a weapon, and the Covenant gains control of it, they'll use it against us. Who knows what power that would give them?" "Chief, Cortana, I have a new mission for you. We need to beat the Covenant to Halo's control room."
"No offense, sir," the Master Chief replied, "but it might be best to finish this mission before we tackle another one."
Keyes offered a tired grin.
"Good point, Chief."
"Marines, let's move!"
"We should head back to the shuttle bay and call for evac," Cortana said. "Unless you'd like to walk home."
"No thanks," Keyes said. "I'm Navy. We prefer to ride."
The journey out of the detention area and back to the launch bay was hairy, but not quite as bad as the trip in. It wasn't long before they all realized that they really could follow the trail of dead bodies back to the launch bay. Sadly, some of the dead wore marine green, which served to remind the chief of how many humans the Covenant had murdered since the war had begun, more than 25 years before. Somehow, in some way, the Covenant would be made to pay. The tactical situation was made even more risky by the captain's condition. He didn't complain, but the Spartan could tell that Keyes was sore and weak from the Covenant interrogation. It was a struggle for him to keep up with the others. The Master Chief signaled for the team to halt. Keyes, out of breath, favored him with a sour look, but seemed grateful for the breather. 2 minutes later, the Chief was about to signal the group to move forward when a trio of grunts scuttled into view. Needler rounds bounced from the bulkhead and angled right for him. His shields took the brunt of it, and he returned fire, as did the rest of the group. Keyes blew one grunt apart with a barrage of the explosive glassy needles. The rest were finished off by a combination of plasma rifle fire and the chief's assault rifle.
"Let's get moving," the Spartan advised.
He took point and moved down the corridor, bent low and ready for trouble. He'd barely gotten 20 meters down the passageway when more Covenant moved in, two jackals and an elite. The enemy was getting closer and more determined the longer they remained. He finished off the jackals with his last frag grenade, then pinned the elite down with assault rifle fire. Keyes directed the Marines to fire on the alien's flank, and he went down.
"We need to go, sir," the chief warned Keyes. "With respect, we're moving too slowly."
Keyes nodded, and as a group they sprinted down the twisting passages, stealth abandoned. Finally, after numerous twists and turns, they reached the shuttle bay. The Spartan thought it was empty at first, until he noticed what appeared to be two light ones floating in midair. Fresh from his encounter with the stealth elite, who had been stationed in the brig, the Master Chief knew better than to take chances. He drew his pistol, linked in the scope, and took careful aim. He squeezed the trigger several times and put half a clip into the area just to the right of the energy blade. A Covenant warrior faded into view and toppled off the platform. A Marine yelled,
"Watch it!"
and
"Cover the captain!"
as the second blade sliced the air into geometric shapes and started to advance as if on its own. The Spartan put three quick bursts into the second alien, hit his stealth generator, and the elite was revealed. Fire poured in from all sides, and the warrior went down. there was a blast of static as Cortana activated the Mjolnir's communication relays.
Cortana to Echo 419. We have the captain and need extraction on the double.
Her reply was nearly instantaneous.
Negative, Cortana. I have a flock of banshees on my tail, and I can't seem to shake them. You'll be better off finding your own ride.
Acknowledged, Fauxhammer. Cortana out.
The radio clicked as Cortana switched from the suit's radio to its external speakers.
Air support is cut off, Captain. We need to hold here until Fauxhammer can move in.
A Marine heard the interchange, and already traumatized by the time spent as a Covenant prisoner, began to lose it.
We're trapped! We're all gonna die!
Stow the belly-aching, soldier! Keyes growled. Cortana, if you and the Chief can get us into one of those Covenant dropships, I can fly us out of here.
Yes, Captain, the AI replied. There's a Covenant ship docked below.
The Master Chief saw the nav indicator appear on his HUD, followed the arrow through a hatch, down a series of corridors, and out into the troopship bay. Unfortunately, the bay was well defended, and another firefight broke out. The situation was getting worse. The Chief slammed his last full clip into the MA-5B and fired short, controlled bursts. Grunts and jackals scattered and returned fire. The ammo counter dropped rapidly. A pair of grunts fell under the Spartan's hail of fire. Within seconds, the ammo counter read 00. Empty. He tossed the rifle away and drew his pistol and continued firing at the alien forces that had begun to regroup at the far side of the bay.
If we're going, he called out, we need to go now.
The dropship was shaped like a giant U. It rode a grav field and bobbed slightly as if some of the outside air swirled around it. As they approached it, Key said,
Everybody mount up! Let's get on board!
And led the Marines through an open hatch. The Spartan waited until everyone else had boarded and backed into the aircraft, just in time. He was down to a single round in his sidearm.
Cortana said, Give me a minute to interface with the ship's controls.
Keyes shook his head.
No need. I'll take this bird up myself.
Captain!
One of the Marines called.
Hunters!
The Master Chief peered out through the nearest viewport and saw that the private was correct. Another pair of the massive aliens had arrived on the loading platform and were making for the ship. Their spines stood straight up, their fuel rod guns were swinging into position, and they were about to fire.
Hang on,
Keyes said as he disengaged the ship's gravity locks, brought the ship up over the edge of the platform, and pushed one of two joysticks forward. The twin hulls straddled a column, struck both hunters with what appeared to be glancing blows, and withdrew. Even a glancing blow from a ship that weighs thousands of kilos proved to be a serious thing indeed. The dropship's hull crushed the hunter's chest armor and forced it through their body cavities, killing both of them instantly. One corpse somehow managed to attach itself to one of the twin bows. It fell as the dropship cleared the Truth and Reconciliation's hull. The Master Chief leaned back against the metal wall. The Covenant craft's troop bay was cramped, uncomfortable, and dimly lit, but it beat hell out of wandering through one of their cruisers. He braced himself as Keyes put the alien aircraft into a tight turn and accelerated out into the surrounding darkness. He forced his shoulders to relax and closed his eyes. The captain had been rescued, and the Covenant had been put on notice. The humans were determined to be more than an annoyance. They were going to be a major pain in the ass. Dawn had just started to break when Zuka Zamami and Yayup passed through the newly reinforced perimeter that surrounded the gravity lift and were forced to wait while a crew of hard-working grunts pulled a load of Covenant dead off the blood-splattered pad before they could step onto the sticky surface and be pulled up into the ship. Although the Truth and Reconciliation's commanding officer believed that all of the surviving humans had left the ship, there was no way to be certain of that without a compartment-by-compartment check. The shipboard sensors read clear, but this raid had demonstrated beyond a doubt that the humans had learned how to trick Covenant detection gear. The visitors could feel the tension as teams of grim-faced elites, jackals, and grunts performed a deck-by-deck search of the ship. As the pair made their way through the corridors to the lift that would carry them up to the command deck, Zamami was shocked by the extent of the damage that he saw. Yes, there were long stretches of passageway that were completely untouched, but every now and then they would pass through a gore-streaked section of corridor, where bullet-pocked bulkheads, plasma-scorched decks, and half-slagged hatches told of a hard-fought running gun battle.
Zamami stared in wonder as a grav cart loaded with mangled jackals was towed past, blood dripping onto the deck behind it.
Finally, they made their way to the appropriate lift and stepped out onto the command deck. The elite expected the same level of security scrutiny as the last time he addressed the Prophet and the Council of Masters. No doubt he'd be dumped into the holding room for another interminable wait.
Nothing could have been further from the truth. No sooner did Zamami clear security than he and Yayap were whisked into the compartment where the Council of Masters had been convened during his last visit. There was no sign of the Prophet, or any of Zamami's immediate superiors, but the hard-working Soha Rolami was there, along with a staff of lesser elites. There was no mistaking the crisis atmosphere as reports flowed in, were evaluated, and used to create a variety of action plans. Rolami saw Zamami and raised his hand by way of a greeting.
"Welcome. Please sit."
Zamami complied. It didn't occur to either one of the elites to offer the same courtesy to Yayap, who continued to stand. The diminutive grunt rocked back and forth, ill at ease.
"So," Rolami inquired, "how much have you heard about the latest incursion?"
"Not much," Zamami was forced to admit. "The humans managed to board the ship via the gravity lift. That's the extent of my knowledge."
"That's correct insofar as it goes," Rolami agreed. "There is more. The ship's security system recorded quite a bit of the action. Take a look at this."
The elite touched a button, and moving images popped into view and hovered in the air nearby. Zamami found himself looking at two grunts and a jackal standing in a corridor.
Suddenly, without warning, the same human he had encountered on the Pillar of Autumn, the large one with the unusual armor, stepped around the corner, spotted the Covenant troops, and opened fire on them.
The grunts went down quickly, but the jackals scored a hit, and Zamami saw plasma splash the front of the human's armor. However, rather than fall as he should have, the apparition shot the jackal in the head, stepped over one of the dead grunts, and marched toward the camera. The image froze as Rolami touched another control. Zamami felt an almost unbelievable tightness in his chest. Would he have the courage to face the human again? He wasn't sure, and that frightened him as well.
"So," Rolami said, "there he is, the very human you warned us about. A dangerous individual who is largely responsible for the 60 casualties inflicted during this raid alone, not to mention the loss of a valuable prisoner, and 6 shades which the enemy managed to steal."
"And the humans?" Zamami inquired. "How many of them were our warriors able to kill?"
"The body count is incomplete," the other elite replied, "but the preliminary total is 36.
Zamami was shocked. The numbers should have been reversed. Would have been reversed, had it not been for the alien in the special armor.
"You will be pleased to learn that your original request has now been approved," Rolami continued. "We have preliminary reports from other strike groups that most of these unusual humans were killed in the last large engagement.
This one is believed to be the last of its kind. Take whatever resources you need. Find the human and kill him. Do you have any questions?"
"No, Excellency," Zamami said as he stood to leave. "None at all."
Section 3. The Silent Cartographer. Chapter 5. D-1128, 1525. Lieutenant McKay Mission Clock. On the plain surrounding the Pillar of Autumn. The rain stopped just before dawn. Not gradually, but all at once, as if someone had flipped a switch. The clouds melted away. The first rays of sun appeared, and darkness surrendered to light. Slowly, as if to reveal something precious. The golden glow slid across the plain to illuminate the Pillar of Autumn, which lay like an abandoned scepter, her bow hanging out over the edge of a steep precipice. She was huge, so huge that the Covenant had assigned 2 banshees to fly cover over her, and a squad of 6 ghosts patrolled the area immediately around the fallen cruiser's hull. However, from the listless manner with which the enemy soldiers went about their duties, McKay could tell they were unaware of the threat that had crept up on them during the hours of rain-filled darkness. Back on Earth, before the invention of the Shaw-Fujikawa Translite engine and the subsequent efforts to colonize other star systems, human soldiers had frequently staged attacks at dawn, when there was more light to see by, and the enemy sentries were likely to be tired and sleepy. In order to counter, the more sophisticated armies soon developed the tradition of an early morning stand-to, when every soldier went to barricades in case the enemy chose that particular morning to attack. Did the Covenant have a similar tradition, McKay wondered? Or were they dozing a bit, relieved that the long period of darkness was finally over, their fears eased by the first rays of the sun? The officer would soon find out. Like all 62 members of her company, the Helljumper was concealed just beyond the border of the roughly U-shaped area that the Covenant actively patrolled. And now, with daylight only minutes away, the time had arrived either to commit herself or to withdraw. McKay took one last look around. Her arm ached and her bladder was full, but everything else was A-OK. She keyed the radio and gave the order that both platoons had been waiting for. Red 1 to Blue 1 and Green 1. Proceed to objective. Over. The response came so quickly that McKay missed whatever acknowledgments the 2 platoon leaders might have sent. The key was to neutralize the banshees and the ghosts so quickly, so decisively, that the ODST troopers would be able to cross the long stretch of open ground and reach the Autumn virtually unopposed. That's why no fewer than 3 of the powerful M-19 rocket launchers were aimed at each banshee, and 3 Marines had been assigned to each of the half-dozen target ghosts. 2 of the 4 rockets fired at the Covenant aircraft missed their marks, but both banshees took hits and immediately exploded. Wreckage rained on the Covenant position. The ghost drivers on both sides of the ship were still looking upward, trying to figure out what had occurred, when more than 2 dozen assault weapons opened up on them. 4 of the rapid attack vehicles were destroyed within the first few seconds of the battle. The 5th, piloted by a mortally wounded elite, described a number of large, overlapping circles before crashing into the cruiser's hull and finally putting the driver out of his misery. The elite behind the controls of the 6th and last ghost panicked, backed away from the wholesale destruction, and toppled over the edge of the precipice. If the alien screamed on the way down, McKay wasn't able to hear it, especially with a steady crack, crack, crack of multiple S-2 sniper rifles going off all around her. She keyed her radio to the command freak and ordered her platoon leaders to move up. The assault force crossed the open area in a run and headed toward the ship's sternmost airlocks. Covenant troops stationed within the ship heard the ruckus and hurried outside and were met by the sight of the still smoking wrecks of their mechanized support and an enthusiastic, if somewhat thin, infantry assault. Most were simply standing there, waiting for someone to tell them what to do, when the sniper's 14.5-millimeter armor-piercing, fin-stabilized, discarding sabot rounds began to cut them down. The impact was devastating. McKay saw elites, jackals, and grunts alike throw up their arms and collapse as the rolling fusillade took its toll. Then, as the aliens started to pull back into the relative safety of the ship's interior, McKay jumped to her feet, knowing that one of her non-coms would do likewise on the far side of the hull, and waved the snipers forward.
"Switch to your assault weapons! The last one of the lock has to stay and guard it!"
All the ODST troopers knew there were plenty of things to scrounge inside the hull, and they were eager to do so. The possibility that they might end up guarding a lock rather than pillaging the Autumn's interior was more than sufficient motivation to make each Marine run as fast as possible. The purpose of the exercise was to get the last members of the company across what could have been a Covenant killing ground, and to do so as quickly as possible. McKay thought she'd been successful, thought she'd made a clean break, when a momentary shadow passed over her and someone yelled,
"Contact! Enemy contact!"
The officer glanced back over her shoulder and spied a Covenant dropship. The ungainly-looking craft swept in from the east and was about to deploy additional forces. Its plasma cannon opened fire and stitched a line of black dots in the dirt, out toward the edge of the drop-off. A sniper disappeared from the waist down, and still had enough air to scream as his forward motion slowed and his torso landed on a pile of his own intestines. McKay skidded to a halt, yelled,
"Snipers! About face! Fire!"
and hoped that the brief parade ground-style orders would be sufficient to communicate what she wanted. Each Covenant dropship had side slots, small cubicle-like spaces where their troops rode during transit, and from which they were released when the aircraft arrived over the landing zone. Had the pilot been more experienced, he would have positioned the aircraft so that it was nose-on to the enemy and fired his cannon while the troops bailed out. But he wasn't, or he'd simply made a mistake, as he presented the ship's starboard side to the humans and opened the doors. More than half the ODST snipers had switched back to their S-2s and had shouldered their weapons up as the drop doors opened. They opened fire before the Covenant troops could leap to the ground. One of their rounds hit a plasma grenade and caused it to explode. A control line must have been severed because the dropship lurched to port, pitched forward, and nosed into the ground. Twin waves of soil were gouged out of the plateau as the aircraft slid forward, hit a boulder, and exploded into flame. Secondary explosions cooked off and the twin hulls disintegrated. The sound of the blast bounced off the Autumn's hull and rolled across the surrounding plain. The Marines waited a moment to see if any of the aliens would try to crawl, walk, or run away, but none of them did. McKay heard the muffled thump, thump, thump of automatic weapons fire coming from within the ship behind her, knew the job was only half done, and waved to the half-dozen Marines.
"What are you waiting for? Let's go!"
The hell jumpers looked at one another, grinned, and followed McKay into the ship. The LT might look like a wild-eyed maniac, but she knew her stuff, and that was good enough for them. The soil was still damp from the rain, so when the sun hit the top of the mesa, a heavy mist started to form, as if a battalion of spirits had been released from bondage. Keyes, exhausted by his captivity, not to mention the harrowing escape from the Truth and Reconciliation, had literally collapsed in the bed the Helljumpers had prepared for him, and slept hard for the next 3 hours. Now, awakened by both a nightmare and the internal clock that was still attuned to the arbitrarily set ship time, the naval officer was up and prowling about. The view from the rampart was nothing less than spectacular, looking over a flat plain to the gently rolling hills beyond. A bank of ivory-white clouds scudded above the hills. The vista was so beautiful, so pristine, that it was difficult to believe that Halo was a weapon. He heard the scrape of footsteps and turned to watch Silva emerge from the staircase that led up to the observation platform.
"Good morning, sir," the Marine said. "I heard you were up and around. May I join you?"
"Of course," Keyes said, gesturing to a place at the waist-high wall. "Please do. I took a self-guided tour of the landing pads, the shade emplacements, and the beginnings of the maintenance shop. Good work, Major. You and your helljumpers are to be congratulated. Thanks to you, we have a place to rest, regroup, and plan."
"The Covenant did some of the work for us," Silva replied modestly. "But I agree, sir, my people did a hell of a job. Speaking of which, I thought I should let you know that Lieutenant McKay and two platoons of ODST troops are fighting their way into the Autumn even as we speak. If they retrieve the supplies we need, Alpha Base will be able to hold for quite a while."
"And if the Covenant attacks before then?"
"Then we are well and truly screwed. We're running short on ammo, food, and fuel for the Pelicans."
Keyes nodded.
"Well, let's hope McKay pulls it off. In the meantime, there are some other things we need to consider."
Silva found the easy, almost off-handed manner in which Keyes had reassumed command to be a bit irritating, even though he knew it was the other officer's obligation to do so. There was a clear-cut chain of command, and now that Keyes was free, the naval officer was in charge. There was nothing the Marine could do except look interested and hope his superior came up with at least some of the right ideas.
"Yes, sir. What's up?"
So Keyes talked, and Silva listened, as the captain reviewed what he had learned while in captivity.
"The essence of the matter is that while the races which comprise the Covenant seem to possess a high level of technology, most, if not all of it, may have been looted from the beings they refer to as the Forerunners, an ancient race which left ruins on dozens of planets, and presumably was responsible for constructing Halo. In the long run, the fact that they are adaptive rather than innovative may prove to be their undoing. For the moment, however, before we can take advantage of that weakness, we must first find the means to survive. If Halo is a weapon, and if it has the capacity to destroy all of humanity as they seem to believe, then we must find the means to neutralize it, and perhaps turn it against the Covenant. That's why I ordered Cortana and the Master Chief to find the so-called control room to which the aliens have alluded, and see if there's a way to block the Covenant's plan."
Silva placed his forearms on the top of the wall that fronted the rampart and looked out over the plain. If one knew where to look and had a good eye, he could see the blast-scarred ground where the ghosts had attacked, the helljumpers had held, and some of his Marines lay buried.
"I see what you mean, sir. Permission to speak freely?"
Keyes looked at Silva, then back to the view.
"Of course. You're second in command here, and obviously you know your way around ground engagements far better than I do. If you have ideas, suggestions, or concerns, I want to hear them."
Silva nodded respectfully.
"Thank you, sir. My question has to do with the Spartan. Like everyone else, I have nothing but respect for the Chief's record. However, is he the right person for the mission you have in mind? Come to think of it, is any one person right for that kind of operation? I know that the Master Chief has an augmented body," Silva continued, "not to mention the advantage that the armor gives him, but take a look around. This base, these defenses, were the work of normal human beings. The Spartan program is a failure, Captain. The fact that the Chief is the only one left proves that, so let's put your mission into the hands of some real honest-to-God Marines and let them earn their pay. Thanks for hearing me out."
Keyes had been in the Navy for a long time. He knew Silva was ambitious, not only for himself, but for the ODST branch of the Marine Corps. He also knew that Silva was brave, well-intentioned, and in this case, flat-out wrong. But how to tell him that? He needed Silva's enthusiastic support if any of them were going to make it out of this mess alive. The captain considered Silva's words, then nodded,
"You make some valid points. What you and your honest-to-God Marines have accomplished on this butte is nothing short of miraculous. However, I can't agree with your conclusions regarding the Chief or the Spartan program. First, it's important to understand that what makes the Chief so effective isn't what he is, but who he is. His record is not the result of technology, not because of what they've done to him, but in spite of what they've done to him and the pain he has suffered. The truth is that the Chief would have grown up to be a remarkable individual regardless of what the government did or didn't do to him. Do I think children should be snatched away from their families, raised by the military, surgically altered? No, I don't. Not during normal times." He sighed and folded his arms across his chest. "Major, one of my first assignments was to escort the Spartan's project leader during the selection process for the two series candidates. At the time, I didn't know the full scope of the operation, and I probably would have resigned had I known. These aren't normal times. We're talking about the very real possibility of total extinction, Major. How many people did we lose in the outer colonies? How many did the Covenant kill on Jericho 7? On Reach? How many will be glassed if they locate Earth?"
It was a rhetorical question. The Marine shook his head.
"I don't know, sir, but I do know this. More than 25 years ago, when I was a second lieutenant, the people who invented the Chief thought it would be fun to test their new pet weapon on some real meat. They engineered a situation in which four of my Marines would run into your friend,
take offense at something he did and try to teach him a lesson. Well, guess what? The plan worked perfectly. The plan sucked my people in, and the freak not only kicked the hell out of them, he left two of them dead, beaten to death in a goddamn ship's gymnasium. I don't know what you call that, sir, but I call it murder. Were there repercussions? Hell no! The wind-up toy got a pat on the head and a ticket to the showers. It was all in a day's bloody work.
Keyes looked bleak.
For whatever it's worth, I'm truly sorry about what happened to your men, Major. But here's the truth. Maybe it isn't nice. Hell, maybe it isn't even right. But if I could get my hands on 1,000,000 chiefs, I'd take every single one of them. As for this particular mission, yes, I believe it's possible that your people could get the job done. And if that's all we had, I wouldn't hesitate to send them in. But the chief has a number of distinct advantages, not the least of which is Cortana, and by taking this task on, he will free your helljumpers to handle other things. Lord knows there's plenty to do. My decision stands.
Silva nodded stiffly. Sir. Yes, sir. My people will do everything they can to support both the chief and Cortana.
Yes, Keyes said as he gazed up into the gently curving ring. I'm sure they will.
The normally dark room was bright with artificial light.
Zuka Zamami had studied the raid on the Truth and Reconciliation, taken note of the manner in which the human AI had accessed the Covenant Battle.net, and analyzed the nature of the electronic intrusions to see what the entity seemed most interested in.
Then, based on that analysis, he had constructed projections of what the humans would do next. Not all of the humans, since that lay outside the parameters of his mission, but the one person in whom he was truly interested. An individual who appeared to be part of a specialized elite group similar to his own, and would almost certainly be sent to follow up on what the humans had learned.
Now, in the room that led directly into the security control center, Zamami laid a trap. The armored human would come, he felt sure of that. And once inside the snare, the human would meet his end. The thought cheered Zamami immensely, and he hummed a battle hymn as he worked.
There was a flash, followed by a loud bang as the fragmentation grenade went off. A jackal screamed, an assault weapon stuttered, and a marine yelled, "Let me know if you want some more!"
"Good work!" McKay exclaimed. "That's the last of them! Close the hatch, lock it, and post a fire team here to make sure they don't cut their way out. The Covenant is welcome to the upper decks. What we need is down here."
The battle had been raging for hours by then, as McKay and her Marines fought to push the remaining enemy forces out of key portions of the Autumn and into the sections of the ship that weren't mission critical.
As the Helljumpers sealed the last interdeck ladder, not already secured, they had what they'd been striving for. Free and unfettered access to the ship's main magazine, cargo holds, and vehicle bays. In fact, even as the second platoon pushed the last of the aliens out of the lower decks, the first platoon, under the leadership of Lieutenant Oros, had begun the important task of hitching trailers to the fleet of warthogs stowed in the Autumn's belly and loading them with food, ammo, and the long list McKay had brought with her of other supplies. Then, once each hog-trailer combo was ready, the Marines drove them down makeshift ramps onto the hardpan below. Once outside and positioned logger-style, the combined power of the LRV-mounted M41 light anti-aircraft guns formed a potent defense against possible attack by Covenant dropships, banshees, and ghosts. It wouldn't hold out forever, but it would do the most important job. It would buy them time. Adding to the supply column's already formidable firepower were 4 M808B Scorpion main battle tanks, or MBTs, which rumbled down off the ramps and threw dirt rooster tails up off their powerful treads as they growled into position within the screen established by the warthogs. The MBT's ceramic titanium armor provided them with excellent protection against small arms fire, although the vehicles were vulnerable should the aliens manage to get in close. That's why provision had been made for up to 4 Marines to ride on top of each Scorpion's track pods. Now, free to withdraw from the grounded cruiser and supervise final loading, McKay left Lister in charge of keeping the aliens penned up. As she exited the ship, McKay caught sight of two heavily loaded pelicans flying off in the general direction of the butte, each with a hog clutched beneath its belly. And there, arrayed on the hardpan in front of her, 26 warthog trailer combinations sat ready to roll, with still more coming off the ship. Their only problem was personnel. As a result of the work, only 52 effectives remained, which meant that the stripped-down infantry company would be hard-pressed to crew 34 vehicles and fight, should that become necessary. Both McKay and her non-coms would all play a role as drivers or gunners during the return trip. Oros saw the company commander emerge from the Autumn's hull. The platoon leader was caged inside one of the loader-type exoskeletons taken from the ship. Servos whined in sympathy with her movements as she crossed the intervening stretch of wheel-churned dirt to the point where McKay waited with hands on hips. Grime covered her face, and her body armor was charred where a plasma pulse had hit.
"You look good in orange."
Oros grinned.
"Thanks, boss. Did you see the pelicans?"
"As a matter of fact, I did. They looked a bit overloaded."
"Yeah, the pilots were starting to whine about weight, but I bribed them with a couple of candy bars. They'll be back in about 45 minutes. When they do, we'll wrestle fuel bladders into the cargo compartments, fill them from the ship, and top their tanks all at the same time. Then, just to make sure we get our money's worth, we'll hook a 50mm MLA autocannon under each fuselage and take those out as well."
McKay raised both eyebrows.
"Autocannons? Where did you get those?"
"They were part of the Autumn's armament,"
the other officer answered cheerfully.
"I thought it would be fun to spot the occasional Covenant dropship from the top of the mesa."
She paused, then added,
"That's the good news."
"What's the bad news?"
"A lot of gear didn't survive the crash. No missile or rocket pods for the Pelicans, and we're almost bone dry on 70mm for their chin guns. We can't count on air support for much more than bus rides."
"Damn," she scowled. Without well-armed air support, Alpha Base was going to be a lot tougher to defend.
"Affirmative,"
Oros agreed.
"Oh, and I ordered the pilots to bring 15 additional bodies on the return trip. Clerks, medics, anybody who can drive or fire an M41. That would allow me to squeeze some additional hogs into the column and put at least 2 people on each tank."
McKay raised an eyebrow.
"You ordered them to bring more bodies?"
"Well, I kind of let them believe that you whistled them up."
McKay shook her head.
"You are amazing."
"Yes, ma'am,"
Oros replied shamelessly.
"Semper Fi."
The Pelican swept over the glittering sea, passed over a line of gently breaking surf, and flew parallel with the beach. Foehammer saw a construct up ahead, a headland beyond, and a whole lot of Covenant troops running around in response to the sudden and unexpected arrival of 2 UNSC dropships. Raleigh fought the urge to trigger the Pelican's 70mm chin gun. She'd expanded the last of her ammo on the last pass, had watched geysers of sand chase an elite up the beach, and was rewarded by the sight of the alien disappearing in a cloud of his own blood. And it didn't look like more were coming any time soon. She keyed open a master channel.
"The LZ is hot. Repeat, hot,"
Foehammer emphasized.
"5 to dirt."
The Master Chief stood next to the open hatch and waited for Foehammer's signal. "Touchdown! Hit it, Marines!" He was among the first to step off the ramp, his boots leaving deep impressions in the soft sand. He paused for a quick look around, then started downspin to the point where the aliens waited. No sooner had the last member of the landing party disembarked than the Pelicans were airborne once more and flying upspin. Plasma fire stuttered down from the top of a rise as the Marines advanced up the sandy slope, careful to fire staggered bursts so the entire group didn't wind up reloading at the same time. The Spartan ran forward, adding his fire to the rest, and sent an elite sprawling to the ground. The Covenant forces were outnumbered for once, and the human attackers wasted little time cutting them down. The whole fight lasted only 10 minutes. Time to get moving. He reviewed the mission objective as he surveyed the LZ. Find and secure a Covenant-held facility, some kind of map room, which the enemy had already captured. The Covenant called the site the Silent Cartographer, which could presumably pinpoint the location of Halo's control room.
Keyes had been very adamant about the urgency of the mission.
If the Covenant figure out how to turn Halo into a weapon, we're cooked.
Maybe, with Cortana's help, they had a good chance of figuring out where the hell the ring's control systems were housed. All they had to do is take it away from an entrenched enemy. The Spartan heard a burst of static, followed by Foehammer's cheerful voice as her Pelican swooped back into the LZ area.
Echo 419 inbound. Did someone order a warthog?
A Marine said.
I didn't know you made house calls, Foehammer.
The pilot chuckled.
You know our motto. We deliver.
The Master Chief waited for the dropship to deposit the LRV on the beach, saw two Marines jump on board, and climbed up behind the wheel. The soldier riding shotgun nodded.
Ready when you are, Chief.
The Spartan put his foot on the accelerator. Sand shot out from under the vehicle's tires, and the hog left parallel tracks as it raced along the edge of the beach. They rounded the headland in minutes and entered the open area beyond. There was a scattering of trees, some weathered boulders, and a swath of green ground cover.
Firing!
The gunner called and pulled his trigger. The petty officer saw Covenant troops scurry for cover, steered right to give the three-barreled weapon a better angle, and was soon rewarded with a batch of dead grunts and a badly mangled jackal. The Spartan drove the warthog uphill, turning to avoid obstacles, careful to maintain the vehicle's traction. It wasn't long before the humans neared the top of the slope and spotted the massive structure beyond. The top curved downward, cut dramatically in, and gave way to a flat area where a Covenant dropship had been docked. It appeared that the aircraft had just finished loading. It backed out of a U-shaped slot, swung out toward the ocean, and quickly disappeared. The noise generated by its engines covered the sound made by the warthog and provided the defenders with something to look at. The gunner tracked the aircraft, but knew better than to open fire and attract unwanted attention. The area beyond was crawling with Covenant troops.
"Anyone else see what I see?"
the second Leatherneck inquired.
"How are we supposed to get around that?"
The Master Chief killed the hog's engine, motioned for the Marines to remain where they were, and eased his way up to a point where a fallen log offered him some cover. He drew his pistol, took aim, and opened fire. Four grunts and an elite fell beneath the quick barrage of gunfire. The response was nearly instantaneous as the surviving troops ran for cover, and a series of plasma bolts blew chunks of wood out of the protective log and set it ablaze. Confident that he had whittled the opposition down to a more manageable size, the chief eased his way back to the LRV and pulled himself up into the driver's seat. The Marines waited to see what he would do next.
"Check your weapons," he advised,
as he hit the ignition switch and the big engine roared to life.
"We have some cleanup to do."
"Roger that," the gunner said grimly. "It looks like we have KP duty again."
There was no telling what the Covenant troops expected the humans to do, but judging from the way they ran around screaming, the possibility of an old-fashioned frontal assault just hadn't occurred to them. The Spartan aimed the vehicle for the front of the complex, spotted the hallway that extended back toward the face of the cliff, and drove straight inside. It was a tight fit, and the warthog wallowed a bit as the big off-road tires rolled over a couple of dead grunts, but the strategy worked. Both Marines opened up on the Covenant troops, and the chief ran one of them down. Then, once the outer part of the structure had been cleared, the Master Chief parked the LRV where the Marines could provide him with fire support, and ventured inside. A series of ramps led down through darkened hallways to the antechamber below. It was full of aliens. The Master Chief tossed a grenade in among them, backed up out of the way, and sprayed the ramp with bullets. The grenade went off with a satisfying wham, and body parts flew high into the air before thumping to the floor. Cortana said,
"Don't let them lock the doors."
Too late. The doors noiselessly flashed shut. The Spartan polished off the last of the resistance, checked to confirm that the doors were locked, and was already on his way back to the surface when the AI accessed the suit's radio.
"Cortana to Keyes."
"Go ahead, Cortana. Have you found the control center?"
"Negative, Captain. The Covenant have impeded our progress. We can't proceed unless we disable the installation security system."
Understood, Keyes replied. Use any means necessary to force your way into the facility and find Halo's control center. Failure is not an option.
The Master Chief was back in the hog and halfway to the LZ by the time the captain signed off.
Good luck, people. Keys out.
If the front door is locked, then go around back. That's what the Spartan figured as the LRV rolled back the way it had come, through the LZ. The Marine seated next to him exchanged insults with a buddy stationed on the beach. They had just rounded a bluff when Cortana said,
"Look up to the right. There's a path that leads toward the interior of the island."
The AI had no more than finished her sentence when the gunner said,
"Freaks at 2 o'clock!"
and opened fire. The Spartan ran the Warthog up a slope, allowing the M41 LAAG to handle the heavy lifting, and positioned the vehicle so the gunner could put fire on the ravine ahead.
"Tell me something, Cortana,"
the Master Chief said as he lowered himself to the ground.
"How come you're always advising me to go up gravity lifts, run down corridors, and sneak through forests, while making no mention of all the enemy troops that seem to inhabit such places?"
"Because I don't want you to feel unnecessary," the AI replied easily. "For example, given the fact that your sensors are telling both of us that there are at least 5 Covenant soldiers lying in wait farther up the ravine, it's logical to suppose that there are even more beyond them. Does that make you feel better?"
"No," the Spartan admitted, as he checked to ensure that both of his weapons were fully loaded.
He charged up the ravine and took cover behind a large outcropping of rock. Plasma bolts melted the stone near his head, and he snapped a quick shot in return. The grunt snarled and dove for cover as a pair of his partners opened up on the Spartan's position. Behind them, a cobalt-armored elite urged them forward. The Master Chief took a deep breath. Time to go to work, he thought. He sprinted from his cover, and his pistol's reports echoed through the narrow ravine. The skirmish took mere minutes. His shield indicator pulsed a warning yet again, and he paused at the top of the ravine to allow it time to recharge. His gun swept the area, and noticed the circular structure that dominated a small depression at the top of the ravine. His shield had just begun a recharge cycle, feeding off the armor's capacious power plant, when the pair of hunter aliens burst from cover and lobbed fire at his position. The first blast struck him square in the chest and sent him tumbling backward. The second shot was stopped by a thick trunk tree. A trickle of blood pooled in the corner of his left eye. He shook his head to clear his blurred vision and rolled to his left. A third shot kicked up a plume of soil where he had lain just seconds before. The chief tossed a frag grenade, counted to 3, then sprang to his feet and sidestepped to his right, firing all the way. He'd timed it perfectly. The grenade detonated, and the flash and smoke briefly confused the aliens. His rounds bounced from their thick armor plates. In unison, they spun to face him, their weapons glowing green as they charged for another salvo. Another grenade detonated in their path and slowed the hunter's advance. They fired through the smoke, and the crash of their weapons thundered through the low ravine. The hunters moved forward, eager for the kill, and realized too late that he'd double back and closed in on them. His assault rifle barked and tore into the gaps in their armor at close range. They screamed and died. The Master Chief followed the terrain as it gradually sloped back down to the west. He dealt with a brace of sentries, then located his objective, a way into the massive structure that loomed above. The human saw a dark, shadowy door slip through the opening. He felt the gloom settle around him. His biochemically altered eyes quickly adjusted to the darkness, and he moved deeper into the structure, pausing only to feed a fresh magazine into his assault rifle.
One level below, Zuka Zamami listened. Someone was on the way. The desperate radio traffic testified to that, and it seemed safe to assume that it was the very human he had set out to kill.
The fact that the transmission ceased amid the clatter of human weaponry attested to the fact that the armored human was here. But would he enter the trap? He had carefully seeded references to the map room into the stream of battle updates. If the humans had tapped into the network using the downed ship's AI, then they would have no choice but to send this fearsome soldier to find it. Yes, the elite thought,
as his highly sensitive ears heard the scrape of a booted foot, a muted click as a new magazine slid home, and the subtle rasp of armor. It won't be long now.
Zamami looked left and right, assured himself that the hunters were in position, and withdrew to his hiding place. Others were present inside the cargo module as well, including Yayup and a team of grunts.
The Master Chief hit the bottom of the ramp, saw the alien cargo modules that populated the center of the dimly lit room, and knew that damn near anything could be lurking among them. Something, instinct or perhaps only luck, caused his heart to beat a little faster as he put his back to a wall and slid sideways. Something wasn't right. Light filtered in through an ornate window, which enabled the Spartan to see that there was an alcove to his left. He eased in that direction, felt a cold weight hit the bottom of his stomach as he heard movement, and turned toward the sound. The hunter rushed out of the darkness, intent on smashing the chief with his shield and finishing him with razor-sharp spines. A steady stream of 7.62-millimeter bullets hammered the hunter's chest plate and slowed the rate of advance.
Zamami, backed by Yayup and his team of grunts, chose that moment to emerge from the relative safety of the cargo module. The elite was frightened, but determined to conceal it, and he raised his weapon. But the hunter was in his line of fire.
Then, as if the melee weren't confusing enough, the second hunter charged in, bumped into the elite, and sent him spinning to the cold metal floor. Yayup, who found himself standing out in the middle of the floor, was about to order a retreat when one of his subordinates, a grunt named Linglin, fired a weapon. It was a stupid thing to do, since there was no clear target to shoot at, but that's what grunts were encouraged to do when in doubt. Shoot. Linglin fired, and the plasma bolt flew straight and true. It hit the second hunter in the back and threw the spined warrior forward and caused him to collide with his bond brother.
"Uh-oh,"
Yayup muttered. The Master Chief saw his opponent start to go down, shot him in the back, and brought the assault weapon back up. The fact that the second hunter was already down came as something of a surprise, albeit a pleasant one, and he looked for something else to shoot. No doubt stunned by the enormity of his error and terrified regarding the potential consequences, Linglin was still backing away when the bulky, armored human raised his weapon and fired. Yayup felt Linglin's blood spray the side of his face as he tripped over his own feet, fell over backward, and used his hands to push himself back into the shadows.
A hand grabbed hold of his combat harness, jerked the grunt into the still yawning cargo module, and held him in place. "Silence!" Zamami instructed. "This battle is over. We must live to fight another."
That sounded very good. Maybe the most sensible thing he'd heard in 100 units. So Yayup held his breath as the human walked past the open cargo module. He briefly wondered if there was some way he could get a transfer back to a normal frontline unit. To the diminutive alien trooper, such an assignment seemed considerably less dangerous. His nerves on edge, fully expecting yet another attack, the Spartan circled the room. But there was nothing for him to deal with except his own twitchiness and the heavy silence which settled over the room.
"Nice job, Chief," Cortana said. "Head through the cargo modules. The security center lies beyond."
The Master Chief followed Cortana's directions, entered a hall, and followed it into a room that featured a small constellation of lights floating at its very center.
"Use the holo panel to shut down the security system," Cortana suggested. And, eager to complete the job before anyone else could attack him, the Spartan hurried to comply.
He was again struck by an odd, near-familiarity with the glowing controls. Cortana used the suit sensors to examine the results.
"Good," she exclaimed. "That should open the door that leads into the main shaft. Now all we have to do is find the silent cartographer and the map to the control room."
"Right," the Master Chief replied. "That, and avoid capture in unknown territory, possibly held by the enemy, with no air support or backup."
"Do you have a plan?" she asked.
"Yes. When we get there, I'm going to kill every single Covenant soldier I find." Chapter 6 D-1144,
38:19, Lieutenant McKay Mission Clock, the hills between Alpha Base and the Pillar of Autumn. Three parallel columns of vehicles are pretty hard to hide, and McKay didn't even try. The combination of some 30 warthogs and 4 scorpions raised a cloud of dust that was visible from more than 2 kilometers away. No doubt the heat produced by the machines registered on sensors clear out in space. Banshee recon flights could have tracked them from the minute they hit the trail, and there was only one logical place the vehicles could be headed, the butte called Alpha Base. It wasn't too surprising that the Covenant not only organized a response, but a massive one. Here, after days of humiliation, was the opportunity to revenge themselves on the beings who had taken the butte away from them, paid a surprise visit to the Truth and Reconciliation, and raided more than a dozen other locations besides. Knowing she was in for a fight, McKay organized the vehicles into 3 temporary platoons. The first platoon was comprised of warthogs under the command of Lieutenant Oros. She had orders to ignore ground targets and concentrate on defending the column from airborne attacks. Sergeant Lister was in charge of the second platoon's Scorpion main battle tanks, which, because of their vulnerability to infantry, were kept at the center of the formation. The third platoon, under McKay herself, was charged with ground defense, which meant keeping ghosts and infantry off the other 2 platoons. A third of her vehicles, 5 warthogs in all, were unencumbered by trailers and left free to serve as a quick reaction force. By giving each platoon its own individual assignment, the officer hoped to leverage the company's overall effectiveness, ensure fire discipline, and reduce the possibility of casualties caused by friendly fire, a real danger in the kind of melee that she expected. As the Marines headed east toward Alpha Base, the first challenge lay at the point where the flat terrain ended. Hills rolled up off the plain to form a maze of canyons, ravines, and gullies, which, if the humans were foolish enough to enter them, would force the vehicles to proceed single file, which rendered the convoy vulnerable to air and ground attacks. There was a different route, however, a pass approximately 0.5 click wide. All 3 columns could pass through it without breaking formation. The problem, and a rather obvious one, was the fact that a pair of rather sizable hills stood guard to either side of the pass, providing the Covenant with the perfect platform from which to fire down on them. As if that weren't bad enough, a third hill lay just beyond, creating a second gate through which the humans would have to pass before gaining the freedom of the plain beyond. It was a daunting prospect, and McKay felt a rising sense of despair as the company drew within rifle shot of the opposing hills. She wasn't especially religious, but the ancient psalm seemed to form itself in her mind. "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death." "Screw it," she thought. She ordered the convoy to lock and load and prepare for a fight. Psalms weren't going to win the coming fight. Firepower would.
From his vantage point, high on what Covenant forces had designated as Second Hill, the elite Adu Mortami used a powerful monocular to eye the human convoy.
With the exception of 5 vehicles, the rest of the alien LRVs were hooked to heavily laden trailers, which prevented them from making much speed. Also serving to slow the convoy down was the presence of 4 of the humans' cumbersome tanks. Rather than risk passage through the hills, their commanding officer had opted to use the pass. Understandable, but a mistake for which the human would pay.
Mortimer lowered the monocular and turned to look at the Wraith.
Though not normally a fan of the slow-firing, lumpy-looking tanks, he had to admit that the design was perfect for the work at hand, and in combination with an identical unit stationed on First Hill, the monster at his elbow was certain to make short work of the oncoming convoy. The counter-threat, if that's what it was, would come from the armored behemoths which rolled along at the very center of the human formation.
They looked powerful, but never having seen one in action, and having found precious little data on them within the intel files, Mortimer wasn't sure what to expect.
"So," a voice said from behind him, "the Council of Masters has sent me a spy. Tell me, spy, who are you here to watch, the humans or me?"
Mortimer turned to find that Field Master Noga Putumi had approached him from behind, something he did rather quietly for such a large being. Though known for his bravery and his leadership in the field, Putumi was also famous for his blunt, confrontational, and paranoid ways. There was a good deal of truth in the officer's half-serious suggestion, however, since Mortimer had been sent to watch both the Fieldmaster and the enemy. Mortimer ignored the field commander's blunt tone and clicked his mandibles.
"Someone has to count all the human bodies, write the report celebrating your latest victory, and lay the groundwork for your next promotion."
If there was a chink in Putumi's psychological armor, it was in the vicinity of his ego, and Mortimer would have sworn that he saw the other officer's already massive chest expand slightly in response to the praise.
"If words were troops, you would lead a mighty army indeed. So, spy, are the banshees ready?"
"Ready and waiting."
"Excellent,"
Putumi replied. The gold-armored elite turned his own monocular on the approaching convoy.
"Order the attack."
"As you order, Excellency."
Putumi nodded.
McKay heard the incoming banshees, and the prospect of action banished her butterflies to a less noticeable sector of her stomach. The sound started as a low drone, quickly transformed itself into a buzz, then morphed into a blood-curdling wail as the officer keyed her mic.
"This is Red One. We have hostile aircraft inbound. First platoon is clear to engage. Everyone else will remain on standby. This is the warm-up, people, so stay sharp. There's more on the way. Over and out."
There were five flights of 10 Banshees each, and the first group came through the